Hey everyone, before we get into the episode with Eric, just a quick heads up that now Patreon supporters are getting access to a real awesome new series called the Agenda Free Fitcast, where I'm interviewing people that you've heard on the show before, but coming in with no agenda. So we're talking about motivation, we're talking about, you know, some life lesson stuff. We're going all over the place, and I've recorded about 8 of these so far. They've been outstanding. They are so good. And like I said, they're only going to be for people that are supporting the show through patreon.com, or if you're supporting the show through PayPal with a donation of at least $5 per month. So to do this, you can go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/thefitcast, and you're going to get access to all this extra content week to week. So right now we got episodes up there with Tony Gentilcore and Dan John. Those were both about an hour long. I think Dan John's was more like 40. Tony's was about an hour. And I've also already talked to Jen Sinkler, Molly Galbraith, Jill Coleman, Jonathan Fass, Eric Cressy himself also did one. Lou Schuler. It's just been absolutely outstanding to see how great these are coming out, and they've been a ton of fun to do, and I really don't want you guys to miss out on these. But like I said, I need to give everyone a little bit of an extra incentive to support the show so I can make sure I can bring them to you on a weekly basis. So go to patreon.com/thefitcast. It takes literally less than a minute to get set up, and just support the show at least $1 per episode, and you're going to get access to this stuff every single week like the rest of the Patreon supporters. If you're going through PayPal, just shoot me an email at kevin@thefitcast.com letting me know so I can look up your PayPal donation and get you set up with the right information. So thank you to everyone out there that is supporting the show through Patreon. I promise you, you're going to check this stuff out. It is just outstanding content. It's really, really great, and the feedback has just been nothing but extremely positive. Go check it out, and I hope you enjoy the show with Eric. Hello and welcome back to the Fitcast. This is episode number 332. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have back on the show. It's been maybe about half a year, even a year, since I have talked to good friend Eric Cressy. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm good, bud. How are you?
Good. We were recording a little segment before the show. You're still in sunny Florida, where it is like 32 here in Massachusetts, where this is a beautiful day for us.
Yeah, I'm incredibly spoiled. Our like high of 75 today, and our low of 57 is nothing to really complain about. So it's pretty perfect this time of year.
So first, we're going to get into it in a little bit. Obviously, yeah. There's a great sale on the High Performance Handbook. Something that we've talked about on the show in the past, and something that I've checked out. Super easy to recommend, especially when it's on sale. Not just for people that are, you know, just going into the gym like the weekend warriors, but also I really highly recommend this to people that are personal trainers and strength coaches out there to really get a deep look inside, you know, how you like to program for people, just because like that's something that I took away with me when I interned at, you know, now Cressy Sports Performance with CP back then, was just the simplicity of the programming and just how easy it is to kind of mess that up if you don't have a really good system in place.
Yep, absolutely. That's something we always try to emphasize, is that you have to be accountable to something, whether it's a training partner or a program or something like that. And I think that's something that this resource kind of implements. You also kind of have that feeling of having a coach there with you, just because a lot of the video demonstrations that we go through have the coaching cues that, you know, we would use with our exact clients at the facility. So it's been a really popular resource on that front.
Like, well, what kind of feedback have you gotten from it? Has there been anything, I know you must just get like a bunch of emails from people like saying, you know, how they felt about it.
Yeah. No, I think one of the probably most interesting thing for me is we wanted to make the program as versatile as possible, meaning I wanted to show that if you took a more general strength and conditioning program that included the most important components that you see across all disciplines, that with some subtle modifications, some understandings of energy systems demands and people's outcome goals and things like that, you created some stuff that you could tinker with. So maybe 80% of the program is the same, and then the 20% could be rotated based on what people want. That was the cool thing for me, because you start getting emails from people saying, yeah, you know, I put 150 pounds in my deadlift, But then you'd also get an email from somebody being like, hey, I pulled my hamstring every single time I play beer league softball. And now I've been able to play an entire season and I don't hurt anymore. We actually had a guy, this is kind of a funny story. One of our big league baseball players, when we first launched the book, right when it came out, he's like, hey, you know, I've been doing your stuff for a while, but I'd love to look at this. So I was like, yeah, no problem. You're a long-term client. So I sent it to him. And he actually shared it with one of his teammates, who's kind of like a weight room junkie and all that stuff. And I mean, I had no idea the guy was doing the program. And sure enough, I got an email literally the last day of spring training that the guy had made a big league roster as a left-handed pitcher out of a bullpen. And he went out, he had like an unbelievable year. He had a sub-2 ERA in the big leagues. Wow. Like he did the program as it was. You know, I think he did the baseball specific modifications I had included, but this guy ran it basically as his off-season programming. You know, for our pro guys, like we individualize like crazy, but he took a general program and went out. He pitched an entire season in the big leagues, didn't miss an outing. And you know, it was like, I didn't even know he was doing the program until I got the feedback at the end. So it was pretty cool.
Awesome. And for people that do want to check it out, I will have a link for it in the show notes. If you go through that link, I get a little kickback from the sale, so that is greatly appreciated. Same price, and you know, you're doing $50 off on a couple of packages. And also, Brian St. Pierre, awesome dude. He's over at Precision Nutrition now. Also worked on the nutrition manual for that. Yep. So you're going to get a great nutrition manual as part of it. It's a really nice package. So I just wanted to mention that off the top. We got a lot of great questions from the listeners. You guys really stepped up this time and sent in some great stuff. And we're going to be going all over the place. I want to start with this first one from Mike. My wife and I need to lose over 100 pounds. She has been sedentary for several years, and I have been sedentary for about a year and a half. I have been weight training for most of my adult life, aside from the past year and a half, and my wife bought me a power rack, a power bar, and about 300 pounds of bumper plates for Christmas. That's pretty sweet. We would like to start exercising again to lose weight and build some strength and muscle. What sort of program would you recommend for us? That's a good, you know, lead into this.
So it's a good question. First off, that's a great Christmas gift. That's true love.
Yeah, I know, right?
That much iron. You know, I'd probably take a little bit of a roundabout answer to this. You know, and before you even discuss the programming question, if you're talking about two sedentary individuals who need to lose over 100 pounds each, they haven't done anything for a year and a half, the most important program is the one that is going to make them show up and exercise. Mm-hmm. We can talk about, you know, whether a front squat's better than a back squat, or a split squat's better than a lunge, or a standing cable row is better than a seated cable row. But at the end of the day, none of it matters if it isn't executed. So the question I would ask is, are we studying for the wrong test by even talking about a program? What are the things that they're going to do in their lifestyle habits that are going to, you know, increase the likelihood that they're going to be really adherent to whatever program it is? Mm-hmm. So I know at our facility, like we want our strength camps in the morning, 5:30, 6:30, 7:30, and 9:30. And the reason people continue to show up over and over again, like, I don't think it's our programming. I think it's our environment, it's our energy, and it's the fact that they know that their friends / training partners are there waiting to keep them accountable. So, you know, before even thinking about the kind of program that you're going to be on, you really need to figure out, what are the back end strategies that are going to help me carry this program out? Okay. With respect to the actual training, it's a tricky question, because when you're significantly overweight, there are a lot more orthopedic concerns that you have to keep in mind. For some folks who are that far kind of down, they may get a training effect from just from doing what you and I would consider a warm-up. Mm-hmm. So those exercises may need to be aggressive. There may be a lot of orthopedic concerns with being that heavy, where, you know, from a energy systems development standpoint, spending more time on a bike in the short term might be a good bet. So working in some Aerodyne stuff, you know, that's an important consideration. I personally, for me, you know, I always tend to fall back on the 6-hour rule. And that was something John Berardi introduced a long time ago. He said that if you look at the people in this population who have the physiques they want, you know, the performance they want, things like that, if you go back and you really, really crunch the numbers, those people are putting in 6 hours a week of exercise. For someone who needs to lose 100 pounds, who's not all in yet necessarily, they may not be able to get that 6. But if I can get 6, I'm thrilled. And probably what that entails is 3 full body strength conditioning or strength training sessions a week, and 3 days of quote unquote conditioning. We might do two of them as just like steady state aerobic stuff to start when we're building up a little bit of a foundation, and then one more interval based day there. You know, that's not something I would do if someone was 20 pounds overweight and we want to do a little bit more, but at 100 pounds, I think you have to be cognizant of doing too much too soon. So that's probably ideally how I would phrase it. If you have someone who can't commit that level of time, then you have to combine things. You have to do maybe some of your conditioning at the end of a session, much like, you know, like we run our semi-private sessions for general population folks. I mean, you guys do it at Mike Boyle Strength Conditioning is, you know, they're going to come in, they're going to warm up, they're going to strength train, they're going to condition. So it all fits together. It's how a lot of CrossFit classes are structured. Just make sure above all else that the exercise selection is appropriate. You're not quite ready for high impact activities, and you might not be ready to do a large volume of work until your work capacity is improved.
You know, for when you get like new clients that are, you know, needing to lose so much weight, do you spend a lot more time on just like the warm up and mobility stuff? That sounds like what you're talking about.
You know, I don't think you necessarily have to separate things.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like a TRX assisted squat for someone who may be, you know, considerably overweight, that's a strength training exercise for them. But at the same time, they're actively gaining mobility as they do it. So yeah, are we going to still teach them, you know, foam rolling drills and, you know, and mobility warm-up drills and things like that? Yeah, we're still going to do that. But I don't think it's possible to necessarily separate one thing out from the other. Like you do a Turkish get-up, like you're developing whole body mobility, stability, all that stuff. And obviously, you're probably not going to do a Turkish get-up with a 100-pound overweight person on their first day. But it just speaks to the fact that, you know, your body is just kind of like an alternating pattern of mobility and stability, like Gray and Mike have talked about. And, you know, if you establish good stiffness at one joint, chances are you're going to create good range of motion at the other.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, just to throw it in there, we were talking in the stuff that we did for the Patreon people, that you've been flying a lot. And as someone that is now transitioning into doing lots of flights to the West Coast and, like, you know, Japan and stuff like that, give me some pro tips on how to make sure I don't feel like absolute garbage when I get off that plane.
You know, number one, hydrate. This is something I learned in my powerlifting career. So I would often have to cut weight to make my lower weight classes. To give you a frame of reference, and I don't recommend this to everybody, I cut from 186 to 165 in my last meet in that weight class over the course of 48 hours. And a big part of that strategy was I knew I was flying from the East Coast to Las Vegas for my meet. Every time I fly, if I'm not careful, I'll get dehydrated. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. And so I think a lot of people without even knowing are actually really dehydrated. Because you think about it, if you get on a West Coast flight, you might be on the flight for, you know, for 5 or 6 hours. And what are you getting? You're getting those little like 4 ounce bottles, or you're getting one, you know, like beverage service or something like that. So if people don't plan ahead and bring their own fluids, you can definitely get dehydrated really quickly. So that's the first thing. When you're going west, it's generally going to be a lot easier than going east. When you go east, I mean, I've done Ireland twice and I've done England twice at this point. I know you've done a bunch of trips over there as well. And going east is brutal. And really I like to do is I like to fly red eye and then just try to stay awake the day that I get there. It's the easiest way to adjust. So, you know, determine whether you're going east or west coast. Another good one, compression. I was actually talking to one of our athletes who played at the University of Oregon when he was in baseball. He's in the Marlins system now. And he said, I think that all University of Oregon flights, they mandate compressive leggings. That's really, really popular. If you've seen like the skins that guys wear in Aussie Rules football and rugby out there, really, really good idea to use compression. That was actually something that made a big difference for my wife when we flew while she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. Her like lower legs. There, she had one flight that she didn't wear compressive socks, and it definitely did not go well. So we were really, really big on that side of things. So I think hydration, time zone adjustment, and compression are probably your biggest things. The other thing is just like I've seen a lot of people who just don't do well with crappy airport food. I mean, we've all had that awful salad at like the little news cart. Yeah. The chicken's like rubberized and it's 6 weeks old. And like we had a guy that missed our seminar this weekend because he got food poisoning from something he ate at the airport. Like it's just I don't trust food that I eat from like beverage carts. So if you're going to eat in an airport, eat at a sit-down restaurant. Like for me, when I leave Boston, we go to Boston Beer Works. You know, like I know exactly what I'm getting. I know it's been cooked less than 10 minutes away and we know what we can get. But I don't trust food that's just been like sitting out for an extended period of time. Weirds me out.
Yeah, that makes perfect logical sense.
Last one I would say is also get up. You know what I mean? just not sitting for 5 to 6 hours straight is a good move. Obviously, fall asleep, it's one thing, but I mean, I fly almost exclusively JetBlue nowadays just because the legroom is better. I know we're going to feel better. The prices are actually very much the same as every other airline, but I always try to get an aisle seat. I try to get up at least, you know, every hour or two.
Yeah, that's the thing, that when I go to Japan, I'm up every hour. Otherwise, in those economy seats, you're just gonna, you know, feel terrible.
I'll be calling you on that one, since I'm probably gonna have my first Asia trip later in the year. So
China?
No, Taiwan and then Japan. So
it's fantastic.
Yeah, some interesting stuff going on. So I'm excited for it.
Should be a good trip. This is a good question from Chris. You actually just posted, or maybe it was Pete, a couple days ago, a picture of the very first. Again, back then it was Cressy Performance, now Cressy Sports Performance, your very first facility, and really how things have grown since then. Chris wants to know, what are the most important things to know for those just starting out in the business, or maybe even looking to open their own facility?
I think number one mistake people make when they open a facility is they go too big. I think the name of the game is start small. That location that you're talking about was 3,300 square feet. Our rent was $1,100 a month as a sublet. If you walked in the bathroom, like, you needed like a tetanus shot just looking at it. So, I mean, you remember those days, but that was what we needed to do to kind of create a good foundation for our business to be financially successful early on, to make sure that we could grow, you know, slowly and steadily. So I think the mistake people make is they go too big, and not only that, they go too extravagant. Like, I've heard stories about people opening a facility and buying like three different kinds of leg curls. Things along those lines. Buy stuff that you know you need for your clients. Don't buy stuff that you think is cool to have. Like, it's all well and good to brag to your friends about, like, hey, we've got 6 safety squat bars. I'm like, well, if you train a bunch of housewives who will never probably ever need a safety squat bar, then it's probably not a useful invention and initiative. Whereas with us, we use it all the time because of our baseball guys. So you need to understand specifically what your clientele is, and then go from there. But the advice I give to everybody, regardless of what business they are starting, is try to solve a problem. Okay. Don't just try to make money. Because if you're trying to, you know, basically monetize a problem somebody else has already solved, you're just another guy. But for us, we saw a gap in the market. We said, hey, you know what? Baseball players are a wildly underserved population. Nobody is doing a good job training them. How can we do a good job training them? And we organized our facility 100% around that. But when we opened our business, we discovered that by accident. We didn't, you know, necessarily open our business saying, hey, we're going to train baseball players. We saw a problem. We worked to solve it, to grow.
I saw you mention now on Facebook a couple days ago. I mean, you've been training baseball players as kind of your main market for a couple of years. I mean, not even a couple of years. What has it been, like 8 years now?
Yeah, we're coming up on a decade. I'm old.
So
2006 to 2015. Yeah.
I mean, how is it possible with everything that you do with Major League Baseball players that you're still having people come to you that are like pitchers that are being prescribed long distance running? Are you seeing any kind of progress in baseball strength conditioning in the major leagues or even in the minors?
Yeah, but you know what? The world is never going to be devoid of people who are too lazy to learn new things, but more importantly, to apply them. Mm-hmm. I always joke that if you want to change things in baseball, you have to have brains and you have to have balls. It's one thing to know what you need to do. It's another thing altogether to be able to apply it. And those things aren't really happening. I mean, we can talk about, you know, how there may be coaches that disagree with the context of, like, hey, long distance running is good. What it really comes down to is the reason kids long distance run is because coaches are too lazy to write up detailed practice plans. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to say, go out and run 4 miles than it is to say, I'm setting up these 4 stations. Instead of running, we're going to do a mobility circuit. I've got some med ball stuff. I've got bands set up on the fence down here, and we're going to have a core station here. Like, that takes time. It takes effort. It takes initiative. It takes knowledge. It's easier to say, go run, because everybody knows how to run, and it gives the coach a little bit of time to figure out what it is he wants to do. But we know the research is all out there. Like, if you want to look for it, it's there. It's just a matter of it hasn't been applied. I think the other thing that's a little bit tricky in this regard is, there are 2 things I have to consider. One, I think some pitchers have naturally gravitated towards long distance running because it's been an opportunity for them to process their thoughts. Meaning, all right, I had a start on a Monday night. I gave up eight runs in 2 2/3 innings. I'm going to go for a 30-minute jog, and I'm going to think about what I did yesterday. You know, what did I do wrong? What did I do right? How can I learn from this? And I get that, but I think there are better ways for us to learn. Guys who watch video, things along those lines. Everybody processes things a little bit differently. So I think there's that side of things that we certainly have to keep in mind. But I think, even just taking it a step further, a lot of athletes are maybe gravitated towards that because they see the, hey, Pedro Martinez, he ran long distances. Or they have those people that look, oh, I heard stories about Roy Halladay and Roger Clemens, running miles and miles and miles at 5 a.m. the next day. And it's really hard to extrapolate from that because I know a lot of really, really crappy pitchers that ran a long distances too. It's kind of the whole N equals one thing, but it's difficult. So I always try to look at what is the largest body of people doing? Who's really, really doing well? Who's making consistent, clear progress? What can we do to kind of replicate that as opposed to looking at the freak who happens to be doing really well?
This is a good question to just jump off of that. Lewis wants to know, is there a possibility of Eric putting together a detailed baseball-specific strength and conditioning manual? Will this ever happen, and if so, when?
Yeah, maybe someday. Probably not now. I think the reason is I still see our philosophy as being very much in a process. It's evolving each year, and we're integrating things each year that we haven't done in previous years. And I think on a side note, we probably don't really want to compete with our facility. I think when you put a product out like that, in many cases you're basically just giving somebody the fish. And I'm a much bigger believer in teaching people how to fish. And I think baseball is a population that really does mandate a lot of individualization, a lot of education of the athlete so that athlete can be an advocate for themselves. So it's difficult to say that, we're going to do a generalized program and kind of water down the product. So probably not in the short term, maybe in the real, real long term, potentially. But, there are, if you look at the high performance handbook, it's a generalized program, but there's an entire section on, here's how I would modify this if you were an overhead throwing athlete and all that. But that's kind of where I stand on that, I'd say.
This is going to be a little bit of a two-parter. I'm going to break this up a little bit, Michael Mullen's been on the show a couple times, obviously talking about PRI. So before maybe we get into this, if you want to pause and go and check those out too, so you have a little bit of reference for what that is. But let's see. Steven wanted to know how PRI has influenced how you assess people. And I think last time you were on, you talked about how it's changed how you program. But I'm really interested to see if it's changed how you assess new athletes at all.
I'll be the first to admit I don't use the entirely thorough PRI assessment. Mm-hmm. I think it guides a lot more of what I look for with respect to static posture. And don't get me wrong, I certainly will do a lot of the PRI test when needed. I think where PRI probably governs my assessment a little bit more is like the test retest, in the sense that in a classic left AIC posture, right? Mm-hmm. See limited hip intern rotation on the right side. And you may see, symptoms, you may see a lot of different things. So my question is, if I go and I take them through some positional breathing drills and some hip shifting drills, if I put them back on the table, have we, improved their internal rotation without stretching them? And that to me is what tells me this is an alignment issue. This isn't just, hey, let's soft tissue and stretch their hip external rotators. If it doesn't improve, maybe we're dealing with more of a capsular or even a osseous restriction. So it's a bony block or it's retroversion of the hip or something like that. So I think where PRI definitely fit right into our model is I've always been a test retest guy. I want to see if something makes a difference. Just like, if someone has, biceps tendon irritation in the overhead position, they feel unstable. Hey, how do they feel when I guide their shoulder blade into upward rotation and posterior tilt? Or how do they feel when I give a little bit of a posterior push on the humeral head? Does that do it better? And that governs how we train people. So I think PRI has, beyond just, giving us exercises and assessments, things like that, what it's done is it's become a paradigm through which we can view our training. It speaks to, here's why, we're more likely to see a sports hernia on the right side, or here's why, you are more likely to have more lacerator impingement on the right side and a cranky labrum, whatever it may be. So, those are the things that I look at it more to. But I caution against it. And it's funny, I got a tweet from somebody yesterday who's at one of the the Myokin courses and said, hey, you know, me and several other people here are strength and conditioning coaches that are here because we heard about it from Eric Cressy. And I'm thrilled because PRI has made a big, big difference for my overall training approach. But I do think, like, with a word of caution, I'm not a PRI zealot. It's not all that we do. It's not the only thing that we do. And while I believe in the philosophy, the way that I apply it is maybe 1-2% of our overall training load. We still lift. We still sprint. We still stretch. We still do things along those lines that are very, very important. This has just been something that's impacted in many cases when we apply stuff, who we apply them with, how we might coach them, stuff like that. But I think some people do take it too far. And, you know, that's not a knock on the philosophy. That's a knock on people's tendency to naturally take things to extremes. So we need to find a good balance, just like everything else. I mean, we've seen this with a bunch of different philosophies. I'm sure it happened with DNS and, you know, Z Health and, you know, all kinds of other different stuff. We just got to figure out how it fits in. And you, as a strength conditioning coach, or really as any professional, when you've been at this a while, you don't want to overhaul your philosophy. You tinker. You know, I mean, you might change the 1% after going to a wildly profound seminar, but I mean, can you imagine like Mike Boyle after his years in strength and conditioning going to like a new conference, just coming back to his facility and be like, yeah, we're going to do everything different on Monday. You know, it doesn't work because on one hand, first off, you throw the baby out with the bathwater, you're missing out on a lot of the good stuff you've done over the years. On the second, you know, side of things, you walk back in and your clients are like, so I've been paying you for the last 10 years for crappy exercise stuff. Yeah. Like, no, we're evolving. We're not changing.
Yeah, it's kind of scary when you see people go to like a Performit or Summit and then come back and say, yep, no, we're just throwing out the program. You can't just throw what's been working for so long just to bring in something completely new. You got to try to implement it in your system.
And if you talk about like – if you talk to the really successful people in the industry, people who have been at this far longer than I have and have done much greater things – they go to a seminar and they've learned like one or two things and they're thrilled. Yep. It's worth like – I'll listen to a 20-hour audiobook, and if I come up with like a really good line from that book that's going to impact the way that I coach or even give me an idea for a blog post or something like that, like that's what it's about. And you know, the change is going to be bigger the newer you are to the industry. But if you've been around for a while, like I said, don't overhaul. You just tinker.
Yeah, just for reference, if you are going to be making a trip to any of the Perform Better Summits this year, Mike Mullen will be at the Providence one. So if you want like a brief introduction into the PRI concepts, I would definitely recommend checking out his talk. He's been really doing a great job, you know, progressing with that talk.
Yeah, great teacher too. He's got a great way of relating things in a simple manner.
Super lucky that we have him up in Maine.
For
New Englanders. So we got a question, another question from Steven. Good question. You recently opened a second CSP location. Are there any difficulties you have encountered in replicating what you built in Hudson and Jupiter? We talked a little bit about that in the other segment, but just for these listeners.
Yeah, for sure. You know, there were quite a few difficulties, and I think they were all worthwhile in the end. That's nothing that we didn't expect or anything like that. You know, one of the things that we dealt with here in Florida more so than anywhere else was we had to go through a lot of zoning, building permitting, stuff like that, because our renovations were pretty expansive. Like our demolition alone was about $40,000. So we took four separate office spaces that all had like drop ceilings. And so we had to knock down three walls and get rid of a bunch of ceilings, spray paint the ceiling, all that stuff. So demolition alone, we had to pull permits for, and then a pretty massive build out that including adding bathrooms and things along those lines. But, you know, Town of Jupiter is very difficult zoning wise. And probably the most difficult aspect of it is a lot of like the zoning boards and the town council, they only meet once a month. So there's just a really slow, drawn out process. And, you know, I mean, I can get into the numbers of everything, but like to push things through, like we paid $16,000 to a land use attorney to help expedite the stuff. We paid $1,300 for somebody to go up in a helicopter and take a picture of our building from above to verify that we weren't going to impact traffic patterns or any endangered wildlife. You know, $800 for a new survey because the old one was like 10 years old and it needed to be newer than eight. So like these things just kind of like add and add and add up. And they're the things that nobody ever talks about. Once we were close to opening up, we had our plumbing inspection. And from an ADA compliance thing, our plumbing inspector asked us to move the handle on one of our toilets to the other side. And it's one thing to do that. That's actually a pretty easy fix. But you have to pay a $75 fee to the town to get that permitting change approved. So like little things like that, just build and build and build, and you realize that you might as well just be like setting $100 bills on fire outside your facility. So that side of it was very, very difficult. But I do get it, in the sense that you want a clear and consistent look to a town and all that. And you know, we look at it long term. This isn't a business we want to be open for a couple years. We want it to be open for, you know, as long as I'm alive and beyond. So in that context, it was difficult. That speaks to more like the build outs and the headaches. And just, we signed a lease April 1st and didn't get into our facility until the first week in November. So luckily we had some free rent and some time to do all that. So that was eye opening. But I think probably for me, the more interesting one was this wasn't just like starting a new business. In Massachusetts, it was starting a new business and bringing on a new staff member. In this one, effectively what we actually did was kind of combine two businesses. My business partners, Brian Kaplan and Shane Rye, have been down here and doing their thing for a while. And we've collaborated on a number of athletes over the years and become good friends. And you know, we ultimately decided to put our heads together to go a little bit bigger. So they brought in some of their athletic clientele. I brought in a lot of our pro guys and college guys who had followed me and one-time consults and things like that. So we combined two businesses, and that was interesting because every business has a unique culture, you know what I mean, in terms of how things work. And even like combining my mentality as like a Massachusetts guy with like a little bit of a Florida mentality, like the athletes here are quite a bit different than athletes in Massachusetts. They just come from different backgrounds. And you know, you'll see guys in Florida who will like walk in and to train and they'll be in like flip-flops with sand all over their feet. So it's, you just don't see that in Massachusetts. It's not that they're wrong for doing it, it's just a different world. So it's definitely been interesting. Now we had some growing pains just like every other new business, but really it's just a reminder that you have to create clear and concise systems and get everybody on the same page. And you know, just learned a lot about communication, but it's gone very, very well. Thrilled that we did it. And it's been a good chance to kind of expand our reach, expand our brand, and you know, service more athletes and kind of spread our message. So it's something I'm really glad we did.
Was it hard to duplicate the culture down in Florida? Like are those same athletes, are they okay with having, you know, Rage Against the Machine or Rise Against on the radio? Are they going to want something that's a little bit more mellower?
Yeah. You know what I will say? I haven't heard Tiesto once since I came down here. God, thank the good Lord.
Yeah, what a loss.
Yeah, no, you know what? Actually, it's not that different. You know, I think music-wise and stuff like that, they're very similar. But, you know, it's all about, you know, I joke, and this doesn't necessarily apply to, like, our pro side of things and that. Our pro guys, our college guys, they'll run through a wall for us because they have really, like, the carrot at the end of the stick that they're trying for. I mean, they want to get to the big leagues. They want to play college lacrosse. They want to do whatever it is. So, you know, we do have to do very little motivating at that level, because I think a lot of the times guys are coming to train with us because they want to seek out the best in the baseball world. And that's not to sound arrogant or anything like that, but our reputation has preceded us. And as a result, we don't get a lot of guys that need to be handheld. We get guys that are like, tell me what to do and I'll do it. And those guys are awesome. The high school crowd is a lot different because you're always going to have some high school kids who maybe don't want to be there. They're there because their parents are saying they need to be there, or maybe they don't love to train, but you know, they know they need to do it to get to that next level. So I think on that side of things, you have to nurture them and bring them along a little bit differently. But that's no different than Massachusetts. You know, it's largely the same down here, but it's been eye opening and kind of just, you know, creating that culture all over again and trying to create the family environment. And we've been able to do it. And it's been actually a lot of fun. And you just bring more personalities to the mix. And what's kind of funny too is like there's almost like a back and forth that goes on between Massachusetts and Florida, like a little like mini rivalry. Like we might do a charity boot camp in the next month or so and see which facility raises more money for a good cause. And you know, a lot of like the Massachusetts guys will like text me and send messages like that I sissied out by going to Florida and then I can't handle the cold weather anymore. And you know, when it's, you know, snowing 2 feet a day, I'll take a picture of the palm trees while we're out long tossing at the field. Like it's kind of a good back and forth. So it actually has built the culture up even more and created an even better environment, I think.
Come on, man, that's crap. You grew up in Maine, right?
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, what's cool too is it's been an opportunity for a lot of our guys to get a break from the New England weather sometimes.
Yeah.
The cool thing about Jupiter, and I never appreciated this until I got down here, but like when we're in Massachusetts, anytime an athlete wants to come to town, we have to stand on our head to find a place for them to stay. Whether it's, you know, hotel accommodations, Craigslist, staying with another athlete who has an empty room or something like that. when you come to Jupiter, literally everybody has like a high school buddy or an uncle or an old college coach or a vacation home or something down here. Like, I spend almost no time worrying about where guys are going to stay. They always seem to have some place to stay. And for us, I mean, you can fly into Palm Beach International Airport and it's 15 minutes away from our facility. So there are direct flights to Boston, New York, Hartford. So we've had quite a few guys who were like, screw it. I got to get out of this weather. They'll come down, they'll train for a week. So we kind of have like this reciprocity thing going where, hey, just bring your program with you. Well, you'll be ready to rock and roll. So we had guys that actually trained in both Massachusetts and Florida at our facilities this offseason in our pro crew, and actually even in our college and high school crowds. We had some kids who came down to play early spring games here from our high school crowd who would come in and get lifts in while they were on the road. One of our adult clients likes to come down here and play golf for a couple weeks every winter, and she came in and trained. So it's like, it actually has kind of been a way to expand our offering to our clients. They always have a gym waiting for them.
How is the situation going to be? In the past, you guys have had athletes literally stay at your house. Mm-hmm. Two newborns, is that rule going to still be the case?
Put it this way, I mean, Anna largely shut that down when we came down. So trust me, athletes don't want to stay at our house right now. Our dog doesn't even want to stay at our house right now. But I think especially at our Massachusetts house, it's right next to the facility. It's a little bit bigger. You know, we have opportunities like that to do it. And once the girls are a little bit older and they're not screaming in the middle of the night and stuff, it'll get a little bit easier. I think it's kind of cool once they get a little bit older. It's good. You know, it's hard to play with a 4-month-old, but when a kid's, 2 years old and running around, like any visitor is a cool visitor. So a lot of our pro guys can be good on that front. So when the day comes, we'll happily open our doors up, I would say, to them.
Josh would like to know how you handle program design for high school athletes that play multiple sports.
Yeah, I think the first thing you have to do is you have to counsel them on what their competitive year looks like. When is the time you build the athlete instead of building the baseball player, the basketball player, whatever it may be? I think the two biggest points are, one, the summer has to be like sacred. Summer doesn't necessarily mean like you're in season with anything. Summer means you need to be in the weight room at least 3 days a week. And that's very, very important. And you can sell that to guys, even though they may still be playing some sport, because, hey, you're not going to school anymore. You're sleeping late. You're eating mom and dad's home cooking. You have much better recovery capacity to be able to take on more at this time of year. So, I always emphasize that the summer has to be really important. And we have summer guys that lift 4 days a week and do sprint work and stuff and then play baseball games on weekends. Our college guys will lift during the day and go play at night. So it's the off season to me. And that should be sacred with summer. Obviously, it gets a little bit different when football preseason or soccer preseason or whatever starts. But summer is really important. And then you just have to really counsel those individuals that in-season training is a way of life. When you're in season, there are going to be days when you probably don't want to lift, but you have to. You need to get it in. So, twice a week throughout the rest of the year is probably a good bet. And look at opportunities to crank it up. So I talk about in-season training. It's like managing a bank account, right? So when you're in the off-season, you put a whole bunch of deposits in, you stockpile some savings, and then you go out and you play soccer in the fall. You take a little withdrawal. And every time you play your sport, that savings account diminishes a little bit. And every time you get in, put in a little bit of work in the weight room, you put a deposit back in. And what I'll talk to guys about is this time of year, like, hey, you've got 2 1-week vacations over the course of the spring. Get in, get your 3 lifts in those weeks. Try to get a little more volume in. Those are good opportunities to kind of have that little bit of a recharge. So we try to, emphasize that it's about a give and take, but understanding when to give and when to take is really, really key.
So what do you do with the athletes that have parents that want them to be playing year round, where, like you said, you want that summer to kind of be like their off season, but for some of these athletes, they don't have one. Do you have to talk to the parents, or do you just try to program around it? What do you do?
Put it this way, I would never do that with like a 3-sport athlete. Like, if you're playing 3 sports, God bless you, do it, by all means. But you just have to be cognizant of getting your work in. It's a totally different story if you have a kid that wants to play baseball or hockey year round. You have to really counsel those folks. And really, where I've had great success with that is that's an easy example to make with just looking at some of our pro guys who have done well. I could say, hey, you know what, Tyler Beatty was a first-round draft pick twice and will be in the big leagues here pretty soon and won a national championship at Vanderbilt because he rested his body, because he never threw more than 80 innings in high school and took time off and this, that, and the other. So, you know, he followed advice. You know what I mean? He stuck with the plan and it worked out very, very well with him. Adam Ravenel, same things. So we have this track record of guys who have been, you know, high school and in some cases middle school athletes with us who have gone on, had good college careers, have gone to pro ball, all this stuff. And it's because they stuck to a good plan. So I think it's up to us to show them, hey, these guys are doing well. We know that if you throw more than 100 innings in a season, your risk of a shoulder or elbow injury goes up by 350%. Okay. You know, if you tell that to a parent, if they don't buy into it, I'm not sure that's a parent that you want to interact with anyway. And it's frustrating because sometimes you're dealing with great kids that, you know, have very, very good intentions and just want to work hard. So, it's a tough situation, but it's one that we've handled, I think, pretty well over the years.
Augustine, would like any pro tips on how to regain significant ankle or hip mobility?
Okay. So I think the first question is, what is causing the mobility restriction, mm-hmm. right? So your mobility can be blocked off for a number of different things. It can be an osseous issue, right? So if you have someone who has really retroverted hips mm-hmm. or a bony overgrowth on their femoral head or the acetabulum of their hip, like you can stretch them into internal rotation all you want. They're not going to get it. In fact, you're going to make their hip worse. So do you feel tight because it's a bony block? It could be an alignment issue, right? So if you have a weak anterior core and your pelvis dumps forward, that could block off your internal rotation as well. It could be a muscular shortness, right? Maybe you actually have fundamentally short hip external rotators. It could be capsular changes. So the actual joint itself needs some kind of mobilization. It could just be like an issue of adjacent joints being too unstiff, meaning you need more anterior core and glute function to relax things. So there's a lot of, there's a lot of different things that can contribute to a stiff joint. So if you're looking at an ankle, like, yeah, your Achilles and your calves could be very, very tight, meaning either short or stiff, or you could have a raging bone spur on the front of your joint that's blocking you from getting where you need to be. So you have to really figure out what it is that's causing it. At the lower extremity, like if you want something that's very conservative, that usually works for most folks, like a rocking ankle mobile, classic calf stretch, it's a good place to start. Also look at getting away from footwear that has a huge heel lift. And just wonder why your calves are chronically on. Maybe it's because you don't fully extend your hip. So there's a lot of things to look at, but that's, you know, probably a pretty innocuous, you know, not so harmful drill. But at the hip, again, same kind of scenario. We don't really know exactly what's going on that's causing that mobility restriction. But if you're going to kind of work on some different stuff, like a good catch-all drill, like a Spider-Man with hip lift and overhead reach, kind of covers a little bit of everything, things along those lines, any kind of like your progression is to regaining your deep squat pattern, whether it's like a squat to stand or a TRX overhead squat, something along those lines can often work. But, you know, I'd hesitate to say this drill is perfect for everybody because, you know, our body, everyone's different. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to the next question from Mike. The role of shoulder prehab for recreational lifters routine, is proper movement in big lifts enough?
Personally, I don't think it is. I know that's something that's probably debated. And I think really if you look at the history of MRIs of what shoulders actually look like, you don't have to look much further than that to realize that there probably are rationales for including specific rotator cuff stuff. I actually posted the other day just like jokingly on my Facebook page that doing rotator cuff exercises like cleaning your gutters, it's not sexy or fun, but you know, it's something that's going to help to avoid bad things from happening. So, on my end, I think it is important to include them. And if you really look at it, there are a lot of people who are messed up. So like, a study I know right off the top of my head, there's a research study from 1995 that looked at a bunch of MRIs and asymptomatic subjects. And they found that 34% of people have rotator cuff tears, even if their shoulders don't hurt. And this number is actually over 50% when you're over the age of 60. So we know that there is something over the course of our lifespan that is leading to some degenerative changes in our shoulders. So whether that's something that's going to happen regardless or something that we can actually prevent, we don't really know. But on my end, is it really that difficult to do 2 to 3 sets of external rotations a week? You know what I mean? Is it really difficult to do a set of like prone trap raises at the end of your warm up before you go and overhead press or, you know, do a power snatch or whatever? I don't think it's hard. And if it could potentially, you know, keep a lot of these problems at bay, I think that's a pretty safe bet. And I think if you look at the, I mean, shoulder pain obviously isn't back pain in terms of incidence, but if you look at the incidence throughout the population, there are a lot of people who have shoulder pain, especially in a weight training population. And I know a lot of people that have like done cuff strengthening exercise and they've gotten a lot stronger and they've got better fitness results as a result. So I don't think it's, you know, it's hard to say, all right, if you do a well-balanced training program, will your shoulders stay healthy? Maybe. But I like your chances a little bit more if you are going to include just a little bit of rotator cuff stuff and some scapular control drills.
Before we jump into the last two questions, this is where I like to take a second to thank all of our Patreon supporters on the show for helping make sure I can make these episodes every single week. Haven't missed an episode since we started that up, and you guys stepped up to help support the show. You can do it for starting just at just a dollar by going to patreon.com/thefitcast. And with that, you also get access to this really cool series that I've been doing, you probably heard about at the start of the show, called the Agenda Free Fitcast, where I'm now talking to these guests that you've heard on the show a lot and just having a much more open-ended discussion about life and some advice type stuff, really going all over the place with that. And it's been fantastic. I've recorded about six of those so far, and you're going to get access to those, and those are going to be exclusive to only people that are supporting the show through Patreon or through PayPal for at least $4 per month through that. So I just want to thank a couple people like Shane England, longtime supporter of the show, Becky Williams, Eric Meyerberg, and also Tamara Christie. You guys are supporting the show at a dollar per episode. Thank you so much. And again, it is patreon.com/thefitcast. They make it super easy to sign up. And again, you can even set it at a, you know, per month basis. I'm only going to do four episodes per month. So if you do a buck per episode, that's $4 per month. Literally the price of a cup of Starbucks coffee, or even Dunkin' Donuts coffee is getting expensive. But yeah, jump on there and help support the show. It is greatly appreciated. And like I said, you're going to get access to all that extra stuff as well. So I want to bring in a question from Guy, someone who is interning at MBSC right now, one of the most enthusiastic young coaches that I've ever met, and he has a great question. As a strength coach slash PT, there's a lot on the plate, like, for example, work, time devoted to continuing education, trying to practice what you preach by getting enough sleep, squeezing in a session, eating food that keeps you healthy, as well as juggling a lot of other things in life. As a father and business owner, what are the key strategies for time management and ensuring you tick all the boxes? What would you recommend to new coaches today? Again, we kind of talked about this in the other segment, but, you know, just for these folks as well.
No, it's important to reiterate this time. You know, I hear that and I'm like, that's me in my early 20s. You know, I did all that stuff. I lifted at one of the best powerlifting gyms in the country. I did all this stuff. I wrote books, all this. So I get it. There's a lot of stuff to cover, and you want to be the best that you can be, and you want to put in the long hours coaching. So there are a couple things I would tell you. The first thing is prioritize. You have to figure out what it is that is most important to you. So a lot of people ask me, like, you know, how did you get where you are at a young age? This, that, and the other. I didn't spend a penny on alcohol in my college career. That's undergrad or graduate school, not a single penny. That is, I really didn't drink. I didn't really have a whole lot of fun. I worked all through school. You know, when I was my first 2 years of undergrad, still thinking I was going to be an accountant, I was hopping in the car every Friday morning when I finished class to drive back to Maine so that I could put in, you know, basically 12 to 14 hours of work at a gym there to get some experience and make sure that this was an industry I wanted to move to. So I had that side of things. And obviously there's an opportunity cost. Like if you're going to spend money on, you know, going out and having a really good time, it's not money that you can spend on books, going to seminars, things along those lines. So for me, my long-term goals in the context of what I wanted to achieve were more important than short-term social satisfaction. And that sounds like, I mean, like an approach that, you know, makes me think that you need to all deal with a whole bunch of austerity to ever be successful. Well, it's fine to go have fun, but, you know, and I hear stories about guys that are going out every weekend over and over again. Like, that's when you get better. When everyone else is resting and they're out having fun, that's your opportunity to get better. And if you're not doing it, somebody else will. So I think that side of things is easy. It's also a lot easier to get ahead in the industry now than it probably was 10 years ago, because there's so many more resources out there. You know, I mean, they can go observe at facilities. They can hop online and read a bunch of stuff. There are a lot of continuity sites. There's Body by Boyle online. There's Elite Training Mentorship. There's strengthcoach.com. There are all these different places where they can get information much more easily. So you can be more efficient in there. But the only way that you know to really do that stuff is if you prioritize. And when you prioritize, you start to realize how many things there are in your daily life that you think is so busy, when in reality, it's really not. You know, you spend time screwing around on your phone, or you spend time screwing around on Facebook or Twitter, or just doing whatever. Like, it's funny, my wife and kids left a little bit early to go back to Massachusetts before I head up. And I literally have not turned on the TV in 3.5 days. Like, I was joking, like, I should just call the cable company and shut off our cable, because I don't watch TV. I haven't watched a single minute of the NCAA tournament this year. It's not that I'm not a college basketball fan or anything like that. I've had other stuff that's more pressing that I've prioritized. So whenever I hear about, like up and comers in the industry, like worrying about not having enough time or anything like that, I kind of laugh a little bit, because, you know, I used to think the same thing, and then I had kids. I'm like, I don't have time for anything. Like, I have to cut out everything else. So I think really you prioritize, you figure out what's really important, where are the areas that you need to grow to be successful. And you may need to grow in the context of your coaching skills. You may need to grow in the context of your programming skills. You may just need more underlying foundational knowledge. You may need to just become a better business person to market the skills that you have. So prioritize whatever is the most pressing. And then, you know, aside from that, you need to go and you need to figure out, where in your life are you being really inefficient? Mm-hmm. I don't mow my own lawn. I pay somebody to mow my lawn. It's not worth my time. I have other things that I can do. We have a cleaning lady coming to clean our house this afternoon, because there are things that I need to do. So you have to figure out ways to prioritize stuff and figure out what your time is really worth and how you leverage it most effectively. And I don't think that there are a lot of strength coaches who are doing that earlier in their career, because I know I was about as type A as they came, and I was off to a good start in my career, and I didn't know how to do it. So I think it's just something we all get better at as life throws us more responsibilities and more curveballs. We just get better and better at adjusting to them and adapting. And I know we joked kind of before we came on the air, but like, if you look at like the email interactions Mike Boyle and I have had over the years, the overwhelming majority of them all take place before 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the best time to get work done. And I don't see a whole lot of like 23, 24-year-old coaches that are getting up at like 5 a.m. to study for 2 hours before they see their first client or something. So I take advantage of the morning and try to be as productive as I can and get out of the way. Listen to audiobooks in the car to try to get, you know, stuff going that way. So it's just, there's ways to cram it all in if you're willing to prioritize and you understand where the inefficiencies in your life are.
I think that is the perfect place to wrap this thing up. like we said before, High Performance Handbook is now on sale, and you can grab it through the go to thefitcast.com. If you click on the show notes for episode number 332, there's going to be a link like right at the top for it on there. But also, I know, Eric, you have a lot of other awesome stuff going on. Of course, ericcressy.com and at Eric Cressy on Twitter. Is there anything else that people should, you know, keep an eye out for?
No, man, that's about it. Just the same old stuff, but different day.
Well, I mean, I guess you're definitely going to be doing, I think you're in at least one of the Perform Betters this year, right?
Yep. For the summer. I'm in Providence and I'm in Long Beach. We actually just did the Fort Lauderdale one day a couple weeks ago down here in Florida. So I'm excited for another year of time there. So actually speaking up in Toronto in early May as well. So a little bit of a full summer seminar schedule.
Very good. Well, again, thank you to everyone out there that is supporting the show. Make sure to check out the High Performance Handbook. Like, literally, if you lift weights, you should go pick this up. It's something that I've really picked apart and, used for my clients and stuff like that. And even for my, you know, working with athletes, there's a lot of stuff that you, like Eric said, like, even if you can pick up, you know, a handful of things out of this thing, it's going to be easily worth its, I guess not its weight in gold because it's an ebook, but, you know, it's definitely going to be worth its value. So, Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to jump back on. I'm happy to hear that things are going well and that you're enjoying that. It's snowing. I'm not kidding. It just started snowing outside.
Sorry, man.
It's March 30th and it's snowing outside. But yeah, Eric, we'll definitely talk to you down the road, and thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.